Before I begin, I just want to mention that one of the greatest forms of a tribute and honor that we can pay to the deceased is the Learning Torah in their memory. And I, in that light, I want to dedicate the learning tonight, this year tonight, to the memory of my mother-in-law, Shari Jacob, Sarah Bas Yisrael, and hopefully, please remind me, we'll say a Kaddish Rabbanan after the class. The subject that we're discussing tonight is obviously a very complicated one for many reasons. I believe I have a heavy burden here tonight, because I'm going to try and elucidate areas that are complicated, the areas of kashrut, the laws pertaining to forbidden food, and the other area which is known as nida. Nida is the term for the woman when she's in a state of menstruation, and we're not really interested in that only insofar as it affects the role, the permissiveness of having relations within the marital context. So those are two areas of prohibition in Judaism about which there is a great deal, in my opinion, a great deal of misunderstanding. And I just want to begin with a certain general introduction. I think most people, fair people, objective people, when they approach Judaism, they see that there are different types of laws in the system. And some of those laws are referred to as mishpatim. I guess the term would be ordinances. And these are referred to as the rational laws. For example, thou shalt not steal, and thou shalt not murder. Laws, primarily those laws that pertain to our relationships between man and man. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The obligation to help the needy, to give charity, and honor thy father and mother. And most people find tremendous inspiration in that. These are things that are very appealing to the rational side of people, so they call these the rational laws. And many people limit their observance of Judaism or their respect for Judaism to these types of laws. Of course, there are many, many others that would fit into that category. But then there's another category, which is referred to as the testimonies. Agus is the term in Hebrew. And this, too, is appealing to human reason once you understand the idea behind it. For example, the obligation to eat the matzah on Passover. So in and of itself, what is the point? But it's something which calls to mind historical occurrences, observances, that things that we observe because of the historical experiences that are so important they're associated with, such as the command to dwell in the booth, to construct a hut and dwell in the booth for 7 days on Sukkot. And that we do because it brings to mind the fact that God protected us when we were in the desert. So therefore it's associated with historical ideas which are very important. So again, I guess you could call it rational. You don't have a problem with that. The Torah is not asking you to accept something which doesn't make any sense, or to accept something purely on the basis of faith. But then there's another category of laws. And the Torah uses a different term. The term in Hebrew is chok, or chukim, and that's translated as statutes. And in this area, there's a tremendous amount, in my opinion, of misunderstanding. And I can understand what the basis of that misunderstanding is. For example, the laws pertaining to what we call shatnez, that is, to mix wool and linen together in one garment. And what reason could there possibly be for that? What difference does it make what types of materials would exist inside of a garment? So that's referred to as a statute. There are many laws in that category, and there are many people that are convinced that these laws really have no reason, and they are decrees of the king. And that's the terminology that's used. It's decrees of the king. And in that category, many people would place the laws pertaining to forbidden food. I want to concentrate on the laws pertaining to forbidden food, and then I want to discuss the concept of nida. I'm using the term nida, I assume everybody knows what I mean by that term. If I do use a Hebrew term, and there's a requirement for translation, please raise your hand. Before we go any further, I want to make it very clear that in my opinion, there is a very significant misunderstanding that is being propounded. And it's not necessarily a misunderstanding which is only by people that don't study the Torah. I don't want to use the word ignorant. But it's a misunderstanding which is being propounded by many people from within, by rabbis, by teachers, and people who write commentaries, and who basically frame the manner in which people understand the ideas of Torah. In my opinion, there's a fundamental misunderstanding. And in this sense, you might say that I'm in disagreement with a certain section of perhaps what might even be considered to be mainstream, although I don't know if it's mainstream. It's really not of importance to me. Anybody can check the basic ideas, the basic authority, and that is to say that there is no doubt whatsoever that it's not feasible to maintain that there's any law in the Torah that has no rationality to it, that is simply a decree that makes no sense, that doesn't improve our lives, that has no meaning, and that it's something that we do simply because God commanded it. That is to say, that a person would maintain that God commanded things that have no basis whatsoever in terms of improving our lives, and it's purely arbitrary, and it's just for obedience, that is contrary to the entire Torah, and the view of all of the greatest thinkers, including the Rambam, Maimonides, Nachmanides, Ibn Ezra, and it's from the Torah itself. The Torah itself maintains it is not a vain thing for you. It is not an empty thing for you. I've given you these statutes, righteous statutes, for your good. L'tov loch kol hayom, for your good all the days. And the Rambam discusses this, the very notion that God, we maintain that God is a being of infinite wisdom and has no need whatsoever for our observance. He derives no benefit from our worship of him. Therefore, to maintain that we would criticize a human ruler who makes up laws that don't have any real value or purpose and are just senseless and arbitrary, how much more so to say that about the Creator, the Supreme Being of Beings? So therefore, he says, and it's not just the Rambam, it's every legitimate, every great authority of the Torah, that every law of the Torah is based upon the most profound understanding of human nature. In fact, the source that he uses is the rabbis of the Talmud say that Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, was the wisest of all men, and he discovered the reasons for all of the mitzvahs except for the mitzvah pertaining to the red heifer, Paraduma, the red heifer, which I'm not going to go into tonight. But what the Rambam says from that is, don't you see what they're saying? If that's the case, then all of the mitzvahs have reasons, because how else could he have discovered it? Now, there's a difference, however, because in the case of the Mishpatim that I started out with, the basic ordinances, the logic is apparent on the surface. It's not difficult to discover why it's important to honor your father and mother, why it's important to return the lost object of your friend. So those are commandments in which human reason itself would have been able to discover it, maybe not in the exact form. However, the statutes are laws which on their surface do not seem to have any apparent value. Human reason in and of itself could not have discovered it, but after the fact, once you probe into it, if you have the capacity to do so, you will discover tremendous wisdom. That is to say, there is tremendous wisdom lying at the heart of all of these areas which are referred to as statutes. So I categorically reject the notion that there are mitzvot in the Torah that do not contain the most profound usefulness and wisdom and insight, provided we have the ability to delve into them. I'm not claiming that I'm the one that has the ability to discover the reasons for all of these hidden mitzvot. That depends on a person's level, and certain, as King Solomon discovered more than others. I just want to say that I think it's extremely important that we base ourselves on a firm foundation . And I'm going to seek to elucidate what I've been able to learn over the years. As I said, many times I've had great teachers, and I'm not going to be taking the credit for the ideas, but I'm going to try and elucidate what I've learned about the underlying rationale and the significance in two areas: the laws pertaining to kashrus, which is forbidden food, and the laws pertaining to the area of forbidden a sexual relationship, but specifically the one which we refer to by the term of nida. Now, I maintain my objective tonight is not to try and convince anybody to observe these laws, whether they're observing them or not observing them. That's not my objective. But I maintain that after hearing the exposition, nobody will be able to say that these laws are arbitrary, that they're not rational. I think everybody will agree that they're profound, they contain a profound wisdom, profound rationality, and make perfect sense. Now, whether you want to incorporate into your lifestyle or not, that's what God gave you free will for. Now, when you come to the area, let's start off with kashrus. I'm going to base myself on an exposition of kashrus. I'm going to go from there, because that's the gateway into an understanding of the laws of the forbidden sexual relations. When you come to the area of forbidden foods, it lends itself to a very, very strong question. If a person wants to maintain a critical approach to Torah, I think there's a legitimate question that a person who's being introduced to Judaism and he learns about forbidden food, I think there's a very legitimate question. What does food have to do with religion? What difference does it make what you eat? Why would any religion on earth be concerned about the food that you eat? How does eating this particular food make you a better person, and how does eating a different food make you an inferior person? What does it have to do with spirituality? After all, we're talking about ethical behavior. We're talking about truthfulness. We're talking about compassion. All of this seems to be completely unrelated to the types of food that you eat. That's the question. If I was coming to Judaism for the first time and people expressed this to me, that would be the thing that would bother me. What does God care what you eat? And because it's very difficult for people to answer this question and to explain why the type of food that you choose should make a difference, I can understand. It doesn't bother me that our religion, which is more than a religion, as I said, Judaism is not a religion, it's a way of life. It's intended to be all-encompassing and to perfect man, to bring him to the true objective. So therefore, our religion would have something to say about food, but that's not what you would expect it to say. We'd be talking about the fact that the proper role of food in one's existence, that a person should eat for nutrition, that a person should try and maintain his health. That would make sense to me, because health is important. But to get down into particulars and say that pork is not good, what's evil about pork, or lamb is good, that becomes extremely difficult. And to try and show any kind of a relationship between what you eat and your moral behavior, I think that anybody that would try and do it would have great difficulty. Because of this reason, I think that this is the cause that has led people to what I would regard as not quite correct explanations. Most people, in attempting to explain kashrus, seek to find something in the food itself. So the most popular explanation that's been given over the years, I'm sure you've all heard this, is that the food is not healthy. That's the notion that most people have. That pork is not a healthy food. Or a lobster is not a healthy food. And kosher food is better than non-kosher food. So they're trying to find something within the food itself. That's an approach that's been attempted. In my opinion, that's very, very difficult. It's untenable for many, many reasons. Because, first of all, if you study the Torah is really not a book about scientific information. God did not transmit scientific information to us in the Torah. That's something that God left to mankind to develop through the use of its reason. You can have many other problems, because if that is a great scholar once mentioned, if you're going to say that it's because of health, that these foods are healthy, those foods are unhealthy, so God is concerned about all mankind. Why was this command only given to the Jews? Why wasn't it given to the non-Jews as well? Isn't God concerned about the health of non-Jews as well? You also run into another difficulty, and that is that what about these great individuals who lived before the Torah was given, such as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who did not observe the laws of Kashrus? There are midrashim that mentioned that they kept the 613 commandments, but I don't take that literally. The Rambam does not take that literally. We just read about the case where Avram serves his guests and he serves them meat and the butter, and so it would appear from that they did eat meat and milk. And aside from that, it's just not tenable, because I think modern science would reject the notion that there's any real significant difference. I don't think the Jews are a healthier people than other peoples, and especially due to their eating habits. If anything, it might be a little bit different. So, if the purpose of giving the laws of kashrus was to produce a healthier people, the statistics will not back it up. So I hate to take that kind of an approach.
You wouldn't be able to smoke.
Right, right. It is a very popular myth, by the way, among non-Jews as well. I remember years ago, I don't know how many people there would remember this, but Muhammad Ali, after one of his great comebacks, so they were interviewing him, and he was telling how he got in shape, and he knew this Jewish person, a trainer, whatever, and he said that he ate that kosher lamb. It was that kosher lamb that really did it for him. He believed that there was something to kosher lamb. I don't. Not in that sense. There's also the idea that people have that there's something, some type of a spiritual contamination that is produced by these non-kosher foods, that it has a certain type of an effect upon the soul. It's very hard for me to describe it because it's kind of a mystical idea. If you read, even in the art scroll, you read, they do provide this type of an explanation, and I'm going to be honest with you, I reject that explanation for pretty much the same kinds of reasons. And that is, again, if there's something inherently in the food, which scientists would be very difficult to prove that, I don't think you're going to be able to prove that people who eat one kind of food, assuming that they have the correct values, correct ideas, and a correct lifestyle, and the only difference is that these people have been raised with, if you did a blind test and you wouldn't, people eating wouldn't know which food, you wouldn't be able to show any kind of a differences based upon the food. The same thing, though, wouldn't God be concerned about non-Jews? The same thing, what about the great people, the patriarchs and matriarchs, who lived before the Torah was given and did eat these foods? Interestingly enough, though, this is a law we just learned recently in the summertime. The Rambam says there are many conditions, situations in which you're permitted to eat these foods. For example, the army, when it goes out to war in a state of siege, when they besiege the city, and the Rambam says, and you're permitted to eat all types of food, unless it's very easy to get the food. They do not impose a difficult standard. If there's any kind of an obstacle toward getting kosher food, so the soldier at war is permitted to eat all kinds of food. And he quotes the pasuk that you'll find houses filled with all good things. And that's a reference to the necks of pigs. That is to say, the Torah there is referring to pig as being something which is good. It's a goodly thing. There's nothing inherently, therefore I maintain that there is nothing inherently wrong with the foods that the Torah has prohibited. There are indeed situations, I don't mean only a case of life and death, because life and death is all of the laws except for three can be pushed aside to save a life. Here's a situation where it's not a matter of life and death, it's just a great inconvenience for a soldier in the time of a war to have to bother to get kosher food. I can speculate as to why that's the cause of that, isn't it? Okay, we'll continue. Alright, so if that's the case, what I'd like to do is to try and explain what I believe to be the real reason, the real basis for the prohibitions of the forbidden food. Now, in order to do so, again, I have to go into certain general ideas, then I'm going to go into the specifics. The question you really have to ask is, what is the attitude of the Torah, what is the attitude of Judaism towards the instinctual side of man, towards the physical activities that the man indulges in? And we've discussed some of this in the past. The Rambam discusses it in what's called Hilchos Deos, and the attitude of the Torah towards instinctual gratification is very, very fascinating. I can't go through the entire thing now. But as you know, the position of the Rambam is that a person is prohibited from going to either extreme. The extremes are very attractive, especially to someone who has a very strong religious mentality. You see this even today, that sometimes people... it's called Baal Tshuva. They change, they return to the fold, and they become extremely pious, and there is this innate idea that somehow piety is associated with a certain attitude of asceticism. To the more a person restrains and refrains from any type of physical enjoyment, the holier he is considered to be. That idea has also taken hold among the Jewish population today. that there's something which it means to say that there's something inherently wrong or something inherently evil about physical enjoyment. And that, therefore, the holy person is the one who separates himself and doesn't indulge in all, or he engages in fast, and the more fast and the more negation of pleasure, the holier he is. Well, the Rambam maintains that a person that takes such an attitude, and he says that since envy and lust and honor and the like are harmful for a person, I will separate myself from them to the greatest degree, and I'll go to the other extreme, to the extent that he'll stop eating meat, and he won't drink wine, and he won't marry a woman, that is, he'll refrain from sexual relations, and he won't live in a pleasant dwelling, and he won't wear nice clothing, comfortable clothing, except very uncomfortable clothing, very coarse clothing. He says that too is an evil way, and it is prohibited to live like that. A person that lives according to this way is called a sinner. And he mentions the case of the Nazarite who has to bring an atonement for his soul. And the rabbi said he only separated himself from one thing, from wine. And he requires atonement. Therefore, an individual who separates himself from every pleasure in the world, how much more so? And therefore, he says the rabbis commanded that a person should not restrain himself except from those things that the Torah did set down certain restraints, and a person should not seek to go above and beyond that. Don't become too much of a tzaddik. Don't become too much of a righteous person. So therefore, the Torah prohibits a person going to the extreme of negation of the physical. If you want to put it the other way, what the Rambam is saying is that if a person does not have the capacity to enjoy the pleasures of this world, then he really can't achieve perfection. Within reason. Of course, to go to the other extreme is also to live a life which is better. Of course, we're waiting for that one. What about the other side? Well, of course, you know, the Rambam is against that. Obviously, to live a life which is based purely upon indulgence of the instinctual, that is sinful, that's evil, because that's not the nature of man. That's living an animalistic existence. So what is the solution of the Rambam? It's the famous golden mean. What he says is that a person should adopt. And this is the most difficult thing of all, because if you take a look at the world around you, you'll see that there are very few people that live according to moderation. Moderation is the hardest thing in any area, because the emotions draw you to an extreme, because there's a certain gratification in an extreme. It's very, even in the area of dieting, for example, the hardest part of a diet is when you have to go towards maintenance. You see, when you're first losing the weight, it's a lot easier. There's a certain amount of pain, but then you're not tempting yourself, and you go to the extreme of avoidance. And then it gives you a certain egotistical gratification that you're able to do it, and you have a goal. On the other hand, the extreme of indulgence is obviously an attraction. At least you have indulgence. But the in-between doesn't gratify either emotion. That's the hardest thing to do. That's pure rationality. That's pure discipline. That's what the Rambam says a person should basically aim for, is what he calls the golden mean. That is to say, that he should gratify his basic instincts in the framework of what's necessary for a truly human existence. That is to say, that it should all be subsumed under the purpose. That, let's take eating. A person should not lose sight of the purpose of eating. After all, the purpose of eating is the nourishment, the sustenance of the body. Within that framework, there's nothing wrong with eating enjoyable foods. But he can't make enjoyment the principle, such as a person that eats only those things which give him pleasure, even though they're not healthy. And he avoids those things that are healthy because he doesn't like the taste. That person is not living in accordance with the way of wisdom. The way of the Torah is the way of wisdom. And the same is true with regard to every other indulgence, with regard to every other instinctual indulgence. It all should be under the framework of, therefore, the same with sexual relations. A person should not go to the extreme of negation. On the other hand, a person should not go to the extreme of total indulgence, because that's an animalistic existence. Therefore, it should be subsumed under the ultimate purpose, because what did God create it for? God did not create food. God did not create sex for the purpose of enjoyment. He created it for, there is an objective purpose, and that's the procreation of the species. Of course, God structured it in a way so that in the course of doing it, a certain amount of pleasure accrues to people. Obviously, it has to be incentive. But however, There's nothing wrong with that. A person need not feel guilty. See, Judaism is different than other religions. In my opinion, most religions, I'm not an expert in all religions, do impose a certain sense of guilt. And it's sort of a concession that, well, you have no choice because if you're faced, on the other hand, with the need for procreation, so what are you going to do? But the point being, somehow, that you shouldn't feel too happy about the pleasure that you derive from it, and that's something that you might even feel a little bit guilty about. But you have no choice. Judaism does not believe in that kind of thing at all. And that any of these activities, when they're done in the proper context for the proper reasons, are good activities, and a person should feel enjoyment and should feel happy about the enjoyment, because that is, interestingly enough, and this is the point that I want to conclude with before I actually launch into the specifics. The Rambam has a very fascinating doctrine over here, and this will open up a tremendous window to understanding what Judaism is all about. Because the Rambam goes on to say that our major objective in all of the activities we engage in, whether they be, we're talking about eating, we're talking about marriage relations, we're talking about business, every activity that you could possibly engage in, the Rambam says, has the capacity to be the service of God, can be a mitzvah. And he says the individuals that achieve that level, and that is that whatever they were engaged in was considered to be a service of God, are the patriarchs. And the verse in the Torah that it's based upon is, V'halachta b'drachav, you shall walk in the ways of God. Which means to say that the underlying purpose of your entire existence, you have to maintain, you have to do a lot of things in this existence. A lot of mundane things, because you've got to just keep yourself body and soul together. And you got to keep the house in shape, and you got to make money, and you got to keep your premises and your property. There's a lot of things you have to do which don't seem to have anything to do with the service of God. But the Rambam says that the way we're structured is that everything that we're doing is interconnected, because it's all done for a particular purpose. So therefore, a person who has an objective in life, he has to decide, what's my basic objective in life? And once he decides that everything else that he's doing, one way or another, is a means to attain that objective. You can see that. For example, if a person wants to go to the Olympics and win a gold medal, so he's going to go into a period of training. In that period of training, every activity is going to be worked out in such a way that it fits into the overall pattern. How much sleep does he get at night? What time does he go to sleep? What does he do when he first wakes up in the morning? What kind of exercise? What does he have for breakfast? What about a snack? Does he take off time for a break? Every activity is being factored in, and it's all being done because it's interrelated towards promoting the ultimate goal. So if you can understand that, so he's never free from training. He's always involved in training, and training consumes every aspect of his life. Well, that's what the Rambam says. A person that understands what the true objective of Judaism is, the true service of God, realizes that this is the underlying goal, the underlying purpose, and everything else is assumed under that purpose. How will this bring me closer to God? How will this promote my lifestyle? If that's the case, the Rambam says that every activity that you're doing, if you're doing it for that sake, why am I eating? And what it is that I am eating is because I've chosen these foods, because this is what's best for me in terms of giving me the energy that I need. And why do I need this energy? Not because I just want to be healthy for the sake of being healthy, because I have this fear of dying and I have this fantasy of immortality, but no, because I need the energy to serve God. And when a person calculates, he doesn't just stay up and stay up until there's nothing left on TV and then he plops down and falls asleep and gets up whenever he gets up. But no, he calculates and he decides exactly how much sleep he needs. And then he gets up refreshed to serve God. Then the Rambam says that every activity that you engage in, when you're eating, when you're drinking, when you're working, when you're doing business, and seemingly you're involved in all kinds of transactions, and even when you're sleeping, and even when you're involved in sexual relations, that's a service of God. When a person reaches that level, every activity that you would regard as mundane becomes a service of God, becomes sanctified, because it's all being done to achieve that objective. Of course, that's a very high level, and it's not something that a person can just decide, okay, I'm going to do that. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to live that kind of life. That takes a lot of training. But that is to show you that Judaism is an all-encompassing system, and it doesn't look upon any activity, as being, this is a good activity, this is an evil activity. It all depends upon the context for which it's being utilized. Now, I want to get into the specific area that we came here to discuss. And that is the rationale for the laws pertaining to forbidden food and the laws pertaining to forbidden sexual relations. And there's a reason why I joined those two subjects together. Those two subjects are very much connected. And in order to understand the reason actually is really pretty obvious. It's stated directly in the Torah. For some reason, people don't go directly to the Torah. But a key breakthrough on the path of discovering the underlying reason is to be found in the Rambam. You've heard of the Mishneh Torah, that's the Rambam's code, the codification of Jewish law. So he was the first one to organize and to codify all of the laws from the Talmud. If you study the Talmud, you know how difficult it is to be able to sift through all the different areas and to come to some kind of unified conclusion. He broke down the Mishneh Torah into 14 books. And every book deals with a major heading, and under that heading you have the laws that pertain to that heading. Now, the laws of kashrus, forbidden food, and the laws of forbidden sexual relations, that's called Isurei Bia, he joined them together, just those two areas, and one book. And does anybody know the title of that book? What is the title of that book? It's the book of Sefer Kedusha, the book of holiness. So therefore, according to the Rambam, these laws find their expression in the concept of holiness. And indeed, if you go back to the Torah, at the conclusion of the section of the laws, the Torah does it a number of times, repeats the laws of the forbidden food. It tells you what the reason is. I'll say it in Hebrew, and I'll translate it. V'yiskadishtem, and you shall sanctify yourself. V'yisan kadoshim, and you shall be holy. Why? Ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem. For I, the Lord your God, am holy. So the Torah is telling you that the reason behind the abstention from the forbidden food is because this will make you holy, just like God is holy. Now, of course, prima facie, on the surface, this seems to be absurd, because God doesn't refrain from forbidden food. As in, that notion is absurd. But the idea that we will be holy, just like God is holy, is also very difficult, because how can we be like God? We maintain that we can't even form any kind of a concept of what God is. And yet the Torah is telling us that we have to be holy. Now, the word holy is a very significant idea. Everybody uses the word. But very few people try and define what does it mean by holy. Well, when you use the word, you get a certain sense of what holiness is. The term holy generally means mufdal, to be different, to be separated from something else, to be special and to be unique. So let's try and see if we can understand in what sense man is to be holy as God is holy. See, God is holy because God is completely different than anything else in existence. We have to differentiate between the Creator and the created. God is different in the sense that God is a being, I'll use terms here, the descriptive terms, God is a being who's totally free, who acts purely in accordance with his will, actualized existence, because there's nothing that can thwart God from God's purpose. Now, man is unique. Then you have the created, and you have all the beings, all the animals, for example. We're talking, man too is an animal, but man is an animal that's been differentiated because man has been given a divine element. Now, no animal has the capacity to be free, because since it's physical, since it's instinctual, it's under the control of its instincts, and however it lives because that's the way it's been programmed. Man, too, has an instinctual side, and to the extent that he gives into his instinctual side, he has no freedom. He's living under the compulsion of drive. But man has been given an element which is akin to the divine soul. This gives him the ability to overcome the physical, to attain freedom. To the extent that man is living in accordance with his real nature, which is not to be an animal, which is to be a different type of a being who lives in accordance with his intelligence, with his reason, which gives him the capacity to get a sense of the world of true ideas and to get a sense of the Creator and to get closer to the Creator, to that extent man attains freedom. So that is the That is the objective. The objective of all of these laws is to take man and to separate him from the lifestyle of an animal. We have two different lifestyles. There's the lifestyle of the animal, and you can see many human beings, so-called human beings, who live a lifestyle of an animal. Man is supposed to be a rational animal. God decided that it's essential that we have a system which trains us from day one to live in accordance with a way of life which will transform us from the principle of animal existence to the principle of human existence. What is the principle of animal existence? The principle of animal existence is an animal operates purely in terms of two things: stimulus, response. As soon as a certain desire has been stimulated, then automatically it goes to satisfy. That's the way an animal functions. But that's not the way a human being functions, because man has to act in accordance with his freedom, in accordance with his intelligence. So therefore, the Torah set up a system which would prevent us from doing that. That is to say, when an ordinary person sees a food, it's very tempting, it creates a certain stimulus, so then he automatically reacts and eats it. That's not the way we're supposed to function. The proper way for us to function is that we see something, it creates a desire. That desire triggers off a process of the mind. We have to stop, we have to control, we have to subdue it, and then we have to go through a thought process. Many, many questions have to be answered before you can actually indulge. Is this permitted to us? Is this kosher? Does this come from the class of food that God has said we can eat? And even if it has it been prepared in the proper way? And even if it's been prepared in the proper way, then there's many, many questions before you sit down and eat. And you can see that sometimes you get together in the house and there's the whole issue of brachos. What blessing do you make over this food? So what's happening to people that are living this kind of a life? All of this is being prompted by something instinctual. But the Torah is able to take something which is purely an instinctual process and make it into an intellectual process. Suddenly you're a bunch of thinkers having all kinds of discussions, and you notice the laws pertaining to them are very abstract. Now you're in the world of the abstract, in the world of the conceptual. Finally, whether or not the person engages, indulges, or doesn't indulge is not a result of what's the determination of the instinct, but it's a result of the mind. The mind decides when you indulge, the mind decides when you don't indulge. And slowly but surely, a person that's living that kind of a life is developing a whole different approach. That is the human way of living. Now, I found this summer, because it was in the Sedra of Re'e, in one of the commentaries that I've been reading, took up the whole subject of kashrus. And I'd never seen this idea expressed this way before. And I just wanted to quote a little bit from it to you. And after considering many different approaches to the subject, many of which I've mentioned tonight, he says he would like to quote from the Jewish philosopher Aaron Barth's essay called The Mitzvos, Their Aim and Purpose. By the way, I haven't been able to get that essay, but after hearing what he writes, I think he might be interested. We'll see if we can get the essay. And this guy quotes. Now listen very carefully. Judaism does not demand an uprooting of the impulse, but something more difficult. That man should have mastery over it, and it should not get the better of him. In practice, it replaces the impulse by will. We must examine the implications of these two concepts. The impulse is that factor which brings man to commit deeds without prior thought and deliberation. Will determines human action after premeditation, evaluation, and examination. A premeditated act is a product of the will. An impulsive act is a product of the blind urge. If the Torah wishes to bring us to the attainment of that which is so difficult, it must begin at a very tender age. The present writer is convinced that this is one of the reasons why it imposes upon us, even from our youth, many restrictions specifically related to matters bound up with that impulse which is aroused before all others, namely eating and drinking. The impulse demands forcible snatching of food and eating, whereas the Torah prevents approaching food without prior examination as to whether the particular food is in general permitted to be eaten, and if so, whether it is allowed under the special circumstances which exist at the moment. Perhaps it may in general be permitted, but is forbidden at that particular moment, because this food has been prepared with milk, and meat has just been previously eaten. Or perhaps the eating is forbidden, since the benedictions have not yet been recited, or because it is a fast day, or because the Sabbath, Kiddush, has not yet been made, or because he has not yet fed the animals, whose care is his responsibility. According to Judaism, you're not permitted to eat your own food until you fed your animals. That is to say, as often as one is about to satisfy the impulse of eating and drinking, the Torah brings one from early youth to that pause which converts impulse to will. The pause may be exceedingly brief, but the very withholding of the immediate fulfillment of the demands of the impulse, we call it today immediate gratification, the very questioning and the very performance of actions other than through the medium of impulse, but after the examination and deliberation, are indeed what separate fundamentally and basically the man whose impulse has the better of him from him who can master it. Very beautifully stated. That is the entire purpose of the establishment of a system. And that system, you should not seek to find it in the particular food. I'm not going to go into the reasons why. The Rambam discusses the categories. These are secondary. The primary reason is that there has to be a system that we live by which causes us to gain control over the impulse and to convert it into the principle of what he calls will. So, with regard to meat, it's animals that have split hoofs and chew the cud. And the Rambam gives many, many reasons why it was easier to make it easier for man and so forth. And the same thing is true with fish, fins and scales, and then there are certain birds. But it's not important. The mistake people make is they're looking for something in this particular. It's not. It's a system that God has given us to live by, which has the objective of transforming a person from an instinctual being living according to the principle of instant gratification. And take a look at our society today. If the society could master that one element into someone who lives a premeditated, thoughtful existence based upon the mind. Now that's why the Rambam, those two areas, the two areas which are the most prominent in terms of the pull of the instinctual, are the appetitive, the desire for food, and the sexual instinct. And that's why in both of these two areas, to produce this state of Kedusha, and that's the idea of Kedusha, he couldn't have said it better, a person that's living according to the principle of premeditation, that's holiness. Because he's living in accordance with the principle of the mind, which frees him from being under the control of the instinctual. Now, once you understand that, we can go from here, and I want to go specifically to try and explain to you how it works, and the beauty, and the rationality, and the sensibility of this idea of Nida. There is then a connection between the methodology that the Torah employed in regulating food, and the methodology the Torah employed in the regulating of the sexual relations. And in the course of doing this, I'll try and give an explanation for the prohibition of meat and milk, which is very, very difficult for most people to comprehend. The basic method that the Torah used was to define certain categories of the prohibited. As we've seen in the case of food, certain categories of food are being prohibited, certain are permitted. The Torah used the same methodology with regard to the sexual. There are certain categories of relations that are prohibited. The incestuous relations, adultery as a married woman, and so on and so forth. So therefore, there are certain categories, and then there are specifics. For example, a Kohen, who does the service in the Holy Temple, otherwise translated as a priest, is prohibited to marry certain categories of women. So first of all, you have categorical relations that are prohibited. And that methodology is being used in both areas. However, there's another aspect, and that is to say that even if you identify something as being in the permitted category, you can't just snatch it and eat it. There's a process that you have to go through before you can indulge. So with regard to forbidden food, even if it's a kosher animal, that doesn't mean to say that you can necessarily eat it, because there's a manner that you have to go through in order to prepare it properly. the method of ritual slaughter, or known as shechita. So it has to be killed in a certain kind of a way. And this also entails a greater amount of thought and conceptualization of how the laws are formulated. And even after that is done, the blood has to be removed, and the preparation. So the same is true with regard to the sexual. First, you have to identify someone who, for all intents and purposes, is in the realm of the permitted. But even if the woman is permitted, you can't just get together and have relations. You have to establish a certain bond, a certain relationship, through, as we know, chuppah, the canopy, and kedushin, which is the method of betrothal, of acquisition. There's a method you have to go through, and the objective, of course, is to establish the framework of a family, of a relationship which has the ultimate purpose of establishing a family and perpetuating the system to the next generation. So the Torah is using the same methodology. However, the question, of course, is going to arise, and well, now you've done everything the Torah has told you to do. You've identified the proper woman, someone who's permitted to you. And you've gone through the procedure of marriage, of proper marriage according to Torah law. So now you're permitted to each other. Oh, here comes another prohibition. That is to say that within the framework of the permitted, the Torah has seen fit to create a prohibition, and that prohibition is what we call nida. What's the reason for that? What's the rationale behind that? Well, let's go back to the basic idea. The basic idea is kedusha, holiness. The Ramban makes a very beautiful point on the Seder of Kedoshim. You shall be holy. And he says that the real sanctification is not, and if you think about it, you'll see how true it is, does not consist simply in avoidance of the prohibited. That's a preliminary step. But the real sanctification consists much more in how you relate to that which is permitted. Because, you see, the objective, let's take in food, the objective is to restrain, to be disciplined, not to be a glutton. So the Torah prohibits certain things. But let's face it, Jews have found many, many ways of having all kinds of festivities and parties and banquets and eating and indulging and overindulging in the realm of the permitted. See, because the Torah doesn't legislate perfection. The Torah is a guide. Nobody can legislate perfection to you. You have to do it yourself. So you see that having done that, having eliminated so many of the other categories, the Torah left you plenty, and you can use your ingenuity and put together fantastic banquets, and you can overeat, and you can avoid the real objective. So therefore, the Torah saw fit to create another category of the permitted, to teach you the principle that you can't attain real sanctity unless you're able to regulate the manner in which you relate to the permitted. So what food, in the area of food, what particular prohibited food expresses the idea that you must sanctify yourself in the realm of the permitted? That would be meat and milk. Because the meat is absolutely kosher, and the milk is absolutely kosher. Both are the permitted, but when you bring them together and cook them together, it becomes prohibited. To teach you that very idea that you have to practice, the real goal is to practice that type of restraint in that which you're permitted, because if not, you blow the entire thing. That's the idea. Now let's transfer that to the idea of marriage. That the Torah wanted a person to live with regard to restraint. There's nothing wrong with the sexual enjoyment providers in the proper context. So therefore there's prohibited categories. Yeah, but even in the realm of the permitted, if you act like purely instinctual, if you act like an animal, you're going to lose the entire purpose. Therefore, it was essential to establish that in the realm of the permitted, you have to refrain, you have to restrain. So the Torah had to find a situation. And this corresponds to the same idea that you find in the prohibition of meat and milk, something which otherwise is permitted, but under certain conditions becomes prohibited. The same is true in the area of marriage. And that is to say, I'll try and explain also why this takes effect within the woman. I'm going step by step over here. So therefore, the reason behind the separation, we're not talking about mitzvah yet, the reason behind the separation is because this expresses what the Torah regards as the true idea of a marriage based upon people that are living in accordance with the principle of the Tzelem Elokim, of the divine image. That is to say that it can't be a situation in which you're always permitted to be with each other in a sexual way, there has to be a period of time in which there's an abstention, in which you separate. And that separation accomplishes two purposes. And it's amazing how these two purposes, which would seem to be completely opposite, will be achieved as a result of this one requirement. Because first of all, by separating, what you're establishing is that there's more to the relationship than just the instinctual. That you've got to have a period of time in which you relate to each other in a different manner, in which the other elements, the elements of communication, the elements of the personality, the elements of dialogue, purely unrelated to the physical. Because the relationship itself cannot be purely a physical phenomenon. So you can't be that you can always be permitted to each other. That's one objective of the separation. To be able to manifest the point that you're a different kind of a being, and to withdraw and to redirect those energies towards other objectives, towards the higher objectives, for yourselves individually and for the relationship. So the relationship can now exist on a completely different and on a higher plane. That's one objective. Let's call it the spiritual side. Interestingly enough, however, the truth is that this is essential for maintaining the romantic element in the relationship. Because this is what the rabbis have said. If you understand how physical pleasure works, and what I'm saying over here is that this separation is also essential to maintaining the physical pleasure in a marriage. Because physical pleasure operates on this principle, that the pleasure exists as long as there's a hunger, as long as there's a desire. The more you satisfy, the less the desire, the less the pleasure. A person knows this. A person that eats all the time gets less pleasure from eating. So in order for you to have physical pleasure, you must abstain and give the appetite the opportunity to regenerate itself. There's got to be a period of separation. And that's what the rabbi saw in marriage. Interestingly enough, many marriage counselors will tell you that one of the greatest problems that people have on a physical standpoint in marriage is the problem of, quote, sexual boredom. Just getting bored with each other. So, but this is true. In a sense, this type of emotion is sort of a self-destructive emotion. Because the emotion is to be with somebody all the time. And that's how you feel when you're first dating someone, you're falling in love, you can't wait to be together with them, and you imagine if you were together with them all the time, how fantastically wonderful it would be, and then you're together with them all the time, and it's not what you heard. Because you've destroyed the very element which created the desire in the first place, and that's absence. There must be a certain amount of absence. A certain amount of suspense, a certain amount of desire, a certain amount of anticipation. That's why the rabbis said this idea. The rabbis weren't squeamish. They said the idea that when a woman returns home from the mikvah every month, it's like the wedding night. It partakes of the element of the wedding night because you've given yourself an opportunity to separate yourself from each other in a physical way and to recreate the conditions and the desire and the appetite which makes it a meaningful thing. So interestingly enough, it serves two purposes. It serves a spiritual purpose by giving you the ability to withdraw your energy from the realm of the instinctual and to redirect it to a higher purpose, because the marriage is not just about the physical. It should have a higher dimension. At the same time, it's serving the purpose of maintaining the excitement and the enjoyment of the physical side of the relationship, which is also vital to keep the relationship going. So it's a brilliant system, which anybody would have to agree is. It's an enforced type of a separation, which will maintain all the elements that are necessary to keep the marriage going on both levels. That is what I maintain is the rationale behind the system of the enforced separation of Midah, and I maintain that it's rational, and there's nobody that can argue, there's no way that a person can make a rational argument against it. I've shown you that it's perfectly sensible, it's beneficial, it's healthy, and it's in the best interest of man's spiritual character and its physical character. I just have two points to make to conclude. Of course, the question is, if that's the case, if the objective that we're talking about is really, no one should think that there's something derogatory about, I'm going to use the term needs, I think everybody knows what the term means by now, a woman when she's in a period of menstruation, that there's something dirty or disgusting or derogatory. Anyone who maintains that idea has no concept of what Torah is about. That is absolutely false. That's not the idea at all. And the concept that we use, tumah, which is translated as some type of ritual impurity, has to be explained. It has absolutely nothing to do, there's no taboo involved over here whatsoever. The question is, if the objective is, the real objective is, to create a situation in which there's an abstention. And I've shown you why that abstention is necessary for the relationship and for man's perfection. So why is that mandated by the status of the woman when she has her period? That's the question that we have to deal with. The answer to that, again, is a rational answer. Because you understand the way of the Torah in legislation. The Torah cannot base its laws on things that are purely subjective. Anyone who's been following the Supreme Court realizes that that's basically what the Supreme Court arrived at. And that if you're going to have a system, it has to be objective, there's got to be standards, it's got to be the same. In a sense, the Torah is very much in agreement with that kind of a thing. You can't leave it, it can't be subjective, that each couple will decide when it wants to have its period of separation. That type of thing doesn't work. It's got to be something which is standard, which is objective, which is pretty universal. So there is one process that occurs within one party to the marriage. The woman undergoes a biological process which occurs every month for roughly speaking the same amount of time, which the Torah deems to be the appropriate amount of time, because it can't be too much time separated, it can't be not enough time, it has to be roughly speaking the right amount of time. But it's something which is objective and identifiable. A physical change occurs to the woman every month. Nothing occurs to the man that would conform to what is required. It's in the woman. Moreover, secondarily, it's the time of the month when she could not be impregnated either. So therefore, that also makes sense. On a secondary level, it makes sense, because in terms of the philosophical purpose of sexual relations, it is, after all, for procreation. So that's why the Torah decided to attach this particular thing to the woman, because there you do have the requirements for something which is objective and ongoing and will be occurring, roughly speaking, every month. What change will occur in the man? If that's the case, it will be arbitrary. It's to say that this is the philosophy. Now, every couple, you go and observe it the way you want to do, it's not going to survive that way. Then you don't understand the genius of how the Torah takes profound ideas and legislates it into laws, into religious laws that we live by. That, of course, is a different subject. But I think I've shown enough to explain to you that you have to think of it in terms of the underlying idea, but the choice of nida, of the menstrual cycle of the woman, makes perfect sense, given that you must have something which is concrete and objective around which this should revolve. The final idea would be the idea of mikvah, a much misunderstood institution. And, well, that's the tragedy of Judaism, is the fact that it's not understood, it's misunderstood. Since the Torah decided to give this status, and the idea that of tumah, of ritual impurity that's used, applies to many things. That is to say that the status applies to a woman. So now she's in a state of prohibition. That's all it means. Something which is tumah, impure, means it's in a state in which there are certain prohibitions attached to it. So the way the Torah operates, there's got to be something which changes that state. Something specific, something concrete. The Torah decided that it should be immersion in the mikveh. Immersion in the mikveh is not just, in this case, immersion in the mikveh is always associated with elevation to a higher state of existence. And before the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, could enter the Beis HaMikdash, before he could do the service, he had to go into the mikveh. So you see that, and it's a custom even to this day. And this year was very rough because the holidays came out late, so we went to the ocean before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's a custom to go to the mikvah before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because we're going to come in the presence of God. So it's tahara, to purify yourself. What does that mean, to purify yourself? And what is the idea of mikvah? The Rambam, at the end of the section of the laws of mikvah, he says that, of course, again, this is a decree, because human reason would not work this system out. We ourselves would not work out such a system, that a person should go into the mikvah. So he says, of course, you have the treaty as a decree of God. and to become purified from that which is tamei is not a matter of it's not a matter of physical dirt. You're not removing. It's not that the person is physically dirty, but he says that even though this is the case, there is an allusion, there is an idea, and I want to read to you the idea that just like a person, once he directs his heart to purify himself, once he is immersed in the mikvah, he's pure, he becomes pure, even though nothing has changed physically. So too a person that directs his heart to purify his soul, now the Rambam is taking it from the level of a physical action to the level of the soul. Once a person decides to purify his soul, that's the real purification, from the impurities of the soul. And what are the impurities of the soul? Machsheves ha'avon, thoughts of sin, the deos ha'ros, and false ideas. The real purification is a mental. It's purification of the soul, from its desires to do that which is sinful, and from its involvement in falsehood, in false ideas. Because in Judaism, falsehood, ignorance is evil, and truth is the ultimate good. Once he has decided in his heart to separate from these false ideas and to bring, listen to the words, the hevi nafsho, the mehadas, and he's brought his soul into the waters of knowledge, toho, he becomes purified. And that's what the Bible says, the Zarakti Alechem Mayim Tahorim. God says, I'll sprinkle upon them the waters of purification, and you shall be purified from all of your sins. And from all of your transgressions, I will purify you. So it means to say that the idea of mikvah is really a representative. It's associational. Because we associate water with cleanliness. But the cleanliness we're talking about is not the cleanliness of the body, because you can go into the mikvah perfectly clean. It's the cleanliness of the soul, which should call to mind the true cleanliness, the true purification, to elevate yourself from one level to a higher level. So what the Torah is saying is that this is the sanctity of marriage, that you've undergone a process of separation, and every time you separate, you're supposed to withdraw and rethink and redirect and try and elevate. And now you're going to be coming together again, and for the purpose of re-engaging in the physical aspect of the relationship. But the Torah maintains that the physical aspect of the relationship in a human relationship should not just be an instinctual thing. It should be an expression of the entire picture of the relationship, of the love, of the communication, of all the ideals of the relationship. That's why before you do so, the Torah says you've got to change your state by going into the mikvah and raising yourself to a higher level of existence, so that the marriage you return to will express the true marriage of the higher level of existence. Now, that is something which is not just for the man, for the woman. I know people are bothered by this because the general sense is that the Torah is looking down on women, there's something dirty about what's going on, and she has to purify herself. All this is absolute nonsense. Because if that's the case, then you could be perfectly clean. What do you need a mikvah for that? The truth of the matter is, as I've explained, it saw fit to base this principle of separation to make it concrete through the woman. If that's the case, it's the woman that has to go through the physical activity and to elevate herself, but it's the man who must elevate himself as well. She is the representative of the marriage. Of course, the rabbis say that when a woman comes back from the mikvah, and then she's gone to the mikvah, and now it's permitted. Before they're permitted to engage in relations, she has to actually verbalize to him and say, Tahorah, I'm pure, I've gone to the mikvah. So he too partakes of the concept. So you have many things in Judaism where the action is done by one person, because that's just the way it has to be. But it's not being done on behalf of that person himself, it's being done on behalf of somebody else. In this case, it's being done on behalf of the marriage. So that the whole concept of nida, of the separation, and the going to mikvah, and the return, expresses the ultimate idea of the sanctity of Jewish life, where a person lives according to the principle of the conquest of the instant, and to live a life of godliness, which is expressed in every area of their life, the physical area of their life, the relationship area, the sexual area, Every area, as I've shown you, if done properly, can elevate a person to the highest level of existence and can in fact be defined as a mitzvah and an act of the service of God. So this is what, in general, the concept is all about. I urge everybody to think about it very, very carefully, and hopefully it has explained many things and will lead us all to the proper utilization of the new mitzvah that we've achieved in our neighborhood, not just to the physical use, but to internalizing the ultimate benefits of this, and for the benefit and the blessing of the community and all of Klal Yisrael. I thank you very much. I'd like to say a Kaddish Rabbanan.